This is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. It is pre-recorded, however, so if you call in, no one will answer.
Welcome back to the Michigan Insider, Sports Talk 1050, WTK, the ticket online at WTK.com. We're going to get to the Emigo Blog Roundtable in just a little bit. As I mentioned, I dismissed Sam for the morning as a little under the weather. He battled through it. He made it through half the show. He really tried. If you could have seen what I was seeing on the video through while he was at home, he tried. He's just a little under the weather, and hopefully he'll be back maybe tomorrow, if not by Monday. But we just want to give him a chance to mend because, you know, better to be at 100% than battling through it like whatever percent he might have been. But so we'll get to the round table in a little bit. But in the meantime, Seth Fisher from MGO Blog is joining me a little bit early. And Seth, I appreciate you joining that. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. I just finished another 8,500-word article on Michigan's defense. Hopefully I don't lose another coordinator as soon as I hit save.
I saw something come through Twitter this morning. It was a retweet from Mo Linguist. I'm like, yeah, I followed you for about a month, but I really don't need to follow you on Twitter anymore. So, yeah. So I was reading... And I actually thought of you and the folks that have been putting together all the previews and really trying to dig into, you know, what Michigan's defense is going to look like or what the personality of the coach is like. Every time I read about, like, a lot of times I'm reading like Ravens previews, there's mentions of who's no longer there, right? And it's like, mm-hmm. This really is not about Michigan at all, but it will give you an idea, at least somewhat maybe, of a personality of the coach. Because so here it says, it talks about Rob Ryan is who replaced Mike McDonald.
Okay.
Right? So Rob Ryan, part of the Ryan family, right? Rex, mm-hmm. Rob. Yeah. So Rob Ryan. And the last sentence of this whole thing says, his personality is so different than last year's inside linebackers coach, Mike McDonald, who is now running Michigan's defense. So it's the only point of the whole thing that I took out that had anything to do with Michigan. So what we know about Mike McDonald is he is the opposite of Rob Ryan. But aren't like 90% of cut and coaches can be pretty crazy, but aren't like 90% of coaches opposite of Rob Ryan?
I don't know what Rob Ryan is. I know what the Ryan family is. And I mean, you know, maybe he likes hands, not feet.
I read that. I'm like, okay, you're not giving me any information at all. I was like, I was hoping to pull like a little nugget about, oh, you're comparing who left to what's now there. Maybe you'll give me a little information about who left. And I can, if nothing else, pass it along to whoever might want to hear it. And all it tells me is he's opposite of Rob Ryan. Rob Ryan is the long, gray-haired, flowing, you know,
right,
guy screaming on the sideline. Mike McDonald is still in his 20s, right? And he has short hair. And he, so I'm assuming he's a little more mild-mannered.
I don't think. I mean, the only person I know personally on the staff is Ron Bellamy. I only know him, you know, so well. These are all very even-keeled individuals, and when you're replacing your entire staff in year 7, you're not going to go and get some yellers, right? You're not trying to find someone who's going to, like, you know, motivate people. At this point, you're just trying to motivate them to stay on your team and stick around for the rebuild and get new players on your team. So, I mean, I imagine Mike McDonald, especially because he's the most impressive thing I've seen about McDonald so far is he tweeted out he's looking for analytics help, right? And I was like, okay, that's cool, right? Because we know how that's worked out for Bakich. We know how some of the NFL teams that we follow that have done really well lately, how much into analytics they are. I'm thinking about like, the Chiefs and the Rams, right? And I think that I don't want to guess on how much it hasn't been part of Michigan before, but I know there are certain things that we saw. Analytics is really hard in football, but if you have a lot of detailed information about certain things like how they're aligning and what a linebacker does right at the snap versus what the safety is going to do right behind him. Those things can pick up trends, and I think that NFL teams have really started using those kinds of trends to put their game plans together and decide what to avoid or what opportunities not to give them. I'm getting into the technical weeds here, but like I like that Michigan's exploring that, because I think any time we've had a coach get into analytics, it's turned out positively for Michigan.
We've talked about it here on the show. It's defining the right balance, right? It can't be all analytics. It can't be all look test or whatever the old school is. There is a balance in there. And I'll throw in, Mike Card's very even keel too. I know he can get emotional, so can Ron, but these guys, you're right. There's a lot of even keel amongst those guys. And I also want to, you said something that's kind of stuck in my head, because you threw in analytics and cool in like the same sentence. So for all the math kids that get made fun of in high school for being good at math, coolness is here for math. It's called analytics, and then football's a part of it. And with that, we're going to also say good morning to Craig Ross here as well.
Hey, guys.
Craig doesn't, may not know this, but he's joining us live on the air a little early before the MGo Blog Roundtable joins us here. And that's, I don't know, fine. Do you have anything to add about analytics? Seems a little bit.
Yeah, I've always been interested in analytics, even when I was in high school. In fact, I bought Bill James's stapled together sheets back in the 70s. And I think that was the first real attempt at analytics. And by the way, Ed Fang, you have all my early Bill James. Give them back to me one of these days. But
those
got to
be worth some money, man. I'm he might have sold them.
I don't know. But yeah, when you're in high school and you're interested in that,
poor Ed's still getting called out on the show, even though.
Yeah, you're just nothing. But I guess now it's better or cooler maybe to be interested in that stuff, but I always have been.
I'm fascinated by how much, and maybe it's not that I think it is that much more important in sports, but how much more it gets discussed and how it used to not. I mean, Ed, since you brought up Ed's name, yeah. I mean, Ed's gone off to like conferences, right, that are just about analytics. I was just reading from my alma mater at Maryland, their journalism school, adding analytics, you know, sports analytics stuff, and there's just, It's becoming college programs now, right? There are college programs in, you know, video games too, but this is now taken, as I imagine. I mean, it's kind of is the kids that are in high school that are not necessarily the athletes. Like, I don't know, I look in the mirror and that would be me. Now, I wasn't really the math kid either, but if I really was into math, now there's such a more visible role for you in sports than there was, even though, Craig, you said you were reading it in the 70s, but nobody was talking about it really in the 70s or into the 80s.
Yeah, that's probably true. But now, you know, I mean, I've mentioned on this show using Bill James's early Pythagorean theorem, which is you can apply in baseball or hockey or other sports to see, well, has this team been lucky or not? And it will tell you to a pretty fair degree of accuracy as to whether a team's been lucky in their record or whether they've been unlucky. And I do it. Pretty much, I do it in football. I do it in near the end of the year. I do it in every week in other ball sports, and you can get a fairly good feel, and that's meaningful in seeing, well, how might a team do going forward.
I was going to say the field that analytics have really started to change the game lately is basketball.
Yes.
Brian just recently linked an article by Will Warren, who runs like a Tennessee MGo blog, and about how he puts together his previews, and like it's exactly the same stuff that we do, and it starts with going to this site called Synergy, which is a great site because it looks like, you know, they haven't changed the layout, the format, since like the 1990s. So like it's just like a wall of tiny little data.
The print on matrix too.
Right. But I mean, and you have to check everything against what you know. And that's what's interesting about it, is that you can't just look at it and just come from not knowing anything about basketball and learn something. You have to know kind of the context and what this kind of player is. And then you go in expecting to look for things and find them. But that has really changed how we write these previews, and apparently it's also changed how people in charge of scouting basketball teams find out who, you know, start with what they're going to look at, right? They don't just look at film and find out who know, who scores off the pick and roll, or what their response is to certain defenses and that kind of thing. It's they can find it in these analytics, and I think that's a great example of what analytics have. The new level of analytics in sports is not just what Bill James was doing, which was taking old stats and finding new information, right?
Right.
Now, the next level of that is finding new stats by people watching video and knowing what they're looking for, and then writing down those patterns. And I mean, Brian started doing it with UFR in the mid-2000s. Yeah. And that data, now I have a huge database of all his upon further review articles that tell me like what formations teams used, what personnel have been on the field, what kinds of plays they run, what kind of throws certain quarterbacks make. Those analytics, it's small sample size, but because you're pulling information from video, that opens up a whole new world. And I think football is kind of the next thing where you can find out. We don't know how many rushers teams bring. That's something you can count, right? We don't know how often cornerbacks start down as far as up. That's something you can count, and that can tell you things. And then I think I read an article last year about how Saban uses analytics to decide what blitzes to prepare. And it's more about like how often teams have players in the box or not, including when you have guys kind of running across, right? Like if you have a slot receiver who's going in motion, that guy counts as someone in the box for him. And when he has that means to him that he can activate his safeties against the blitz, or you can use his safeties to blitz because you're going to have one extra guy in the box, so he can add a guy to the box, and he's going to use that to up his blitzing game. And I think that the Chiefs do the same kind of thing. On offense, what they do is they try to look at how often a team blitzes and who's coming and from what direction, and then use that to decide how many guys they want in a box, how they're going to motion, and how they're going to give the quarterback information. So this is the next level, and we were talking about McDonald because that's he's the one who's trying to bring that to Michigan now.
It's going to be really interesting to watch because in the end, football's always been about numbers, right? Because you're trying to game the numbers to get an advantage. Whether even in the old days that everyone's packed in, or if you want to look at the wishbone offense or whatever, it was always about gaining an advantage of creating that. This is just the next version of it, and there's a lot more behind it. There's definitely a lot more like numbers and stuff behind it. I'm curious to see, because it is the youth movement is, we talk about it in the recruiting context a lot. Sam has definitely talked about it in the recruiting context, but there's the youth movement also does bring in some of these newer ideas or gets more activity with these newer ideas than maybe some of the older generation coaches might. I have a feeling McDonald is probably a little bit more into, say, analytics and that kind of thing than, say, Don Brown.
Sure. I think that the analytics for McDonald is probably going to, that's for so he can catch up to Don Brown in certain things. Don Brown has seen a lot of football, and he's coordinated defenses for decades. And nobody on Michigan staff has been the coordinator. I know a couple guys have in their titles in the past, but no one's been, except unless you count like Bellamy at West Bloomfield, right? No one's really kind of run their own show. And Brown has called a lot of college defenses, so he knows. And the things like last year we played Minnesota, and Minnesota has an offense that works in a certain way. And Don Brown figured out exactly how they ran their offense, how exactly they make their checks, and put in a whole bunch of movement before the snap that messed with it. And until the end of the game, Minnesota was just like confounded. They were wasting their entire clock moving their guys around, and Brown had a response to everything that they were doing, and it was brilliant. We wrote about it. I don't know if McDonald is going to be able to have... He's not going to have seen, RPO games to the level where he's going to know what to do.
Not give institutional knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. So, but he can maybe find the same thing by, putting the work in and watching film and taking notes and then and having... it. Once he knows what he wants... that he's got access to an army, right? Like I try to produce this stuff sometimes by watching film and taking down notes, and I got a big spreadsheet, and that's how I do my faux film articles. But he can put an army of kids on video and say, "I need this information," and if they can pull that kind of stuff out, you really can find a lot of things out. Offensive coordinators, more so than they realize, start getting into like a pattern. That's just how the human brain works, and it. A lot of times, if you can recognize the pattern and figure out what the guy likes to call in certain situations and start figuring, you own him.
So then you go Tecmo Bowl on them and you get the right play and then you're going to win.
Right. Which is usually not what football is. Football is usually there. It's a very small playing X's and O's, or playing playing rock, paper, scissors is actually a really small part of football. It's the part that like people understand, so they talk about it all the time, but it's really not a big part of it. But if you can find tendencies, you can get a couple of big plays a game. And a couple of big plays a game really can, you know, make change. Yeah.
A lot more to continue with Seth and Craig, as we'll be joined by Brian as well. On the other side of the break, we'll get to the MGoBlog Roundtable here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA Ann Arbor Accumulus Station. Welcome back to the Michigan Insiders here on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, the ticket online at WTKA.com. It is time for the MGoBlog Roundtable. The fellows are back once again, but no Sam Webb today. Sam is out for the second half of this show. He battled. I got to give him credit. He battled through the first half of the show. He really tried. He wanted to be here, but a little bit under the weather. And so told him to go rest, take it easy, get better. And we'll see Sam back in the air chair either tomorrow or Monday. That being said, we are joined by Seth Fisher and Craig Ross once again, who joined me at the end of the last hour. We're now also joined by Brian Cook. Brian, good morning. How are you?
Good.
Great to have you here on the show. All right, guys, let's jump in. We're going to talk about softball seating. We talked to Hutch about this a little bit, and it would be kind of cool to watch the selection show. Now, not with the results, but the selection show. They hung out at Alumni Field. They sat behind home plate and they put it on the big screen. That'd be a cool way to watch your selections. Granted, it would have been better if they had home games to then stay home and play. So they're out in Seattle. Craig, I'm going to start with you on this one. Your thoughts, the clean version, please. Your thoughts on the Wolverines being sent away to Seattle, not getting a home regional here in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, it's absurd. Michigan is 36-6. They lost four games by a run of those six. I believe they've won 15 of their last 16 or 16 of their last 17. There's no reason to believe that the Big Ten is some second-rate softball conference. I believe 2 years ago Minnesota did pretty well and made it to the College World Series, if I'm correct. I think they did, and I think they played reasonably. Michigan, of course, has played reasonably in the College World Series when they've gotten there and even won it once. You know, and this year the Big Ten made the choice, and I would say it was a reasonable one, to play strictly within conference. And because of that choice, apparently, and the idea that SEC teams just must be better, you know, Michigan ends up playing Washington. Now, maybe this is more less fair even to Washington than it is to Michigan, because Washington also gets, if they get by Michigan, gets to play Oklahoma, who's probably the best team in the country this year. Certainly looks like that's plausible. They have a team batting average over 400. And I think they're averaging 12 or 13 runs a game, something ridiculous like that. So Washington got hurt by this. Michigan was definitely hurt. I don't believe there is a single venue in the Midwest or the Northeast. I think you've got Seattle and you've got, I assume Missouri.
Missouri and I think everything else, Norman's, I think the third most northern venue.
Right. And then you've just got the South. And if you want to have interest in your game from the, you know, it would be nice if you at least had some teams in the North in the tournament, because I think only three Big Ten teams made it. And it would be, and I don't know how many SEC teams. I think seven SEC teams have home venues, which is more than there are Big Ten teams in the tournament. And if you want the interest to be national, you've got to take the game more seriously than this. And they're not. Why I've been arguing on this show and other places for some time that the Big Ten and teams in the North, Northeast, North should get out. They should get out. They should form their own softball and baseball leagues, play in the summer when the game's supposed to be played. Instead, for whatever reason, the Big Ten is kowtowed to the SEC and the Southwest teams, and they play the games in February and March, which are incredibly expensive for the Big Ten teams. The hotel bills, the travel costs are enormous, and there's no reason for it. You can make money on these sports. You can keep the interest on these sports. Instead,
you can pay the players.
Yeah, whatever. You can play baseball with wooden bats, which scouts would love. And there's no reason for this. And I talked to Bill Martin about it. And right, you know, and before he retired, he came to me and said, "Look, you're right. This is nonsense. We'll get out. We'll get out and just form our own. Form our own leagues." And you know, then he got, you know, then he left. Let me put it that way. And there's been no interest since. But
didn't Bakich introduce some sort of plan to move everything back? That even some SEC schools were like, "Yeah, this is something that will make our game more profitable and more viable." Because especially in the coronavirus era, like having your sport be a break-even enterprise is suddenly a much bigger deal.
Sure.
So, like, I thought there was some at least talk about it, if not movement, on the baseball side of things.
There has been talk, but I don't think there's been any movement. But yeah, there's no. And the other thing is, from the Big Ten or the Midwest schools' point of view, you play every game on the road. You play, you know, you're playing every game in Texas or California or Florida against schools from that area or those schools themselves. You know, how about this? If the NCAA is really serious, let's have Texas come up and play a game against Michigan in February, you know, at Fisher Field. You think that's going to happen? They're going to appreciate the absurdity from that from moment one. And so this makes no sense. It makes no sense that teams in the Midwest and the Northeast, you know, have put up with it. And yet here we are still doing the same thing.
So we got a message from Kurt who said the proposal, one that Bakich says is aimed at making college baseball more financially sustainable, suggests the season begin the third week of March with the NCAA tournament beginning in July and culminating in a mid-July College World Series. Now, I will tell you, it'll be roasting in Omaha, Nebraska for that, but I'm all here for it because it makes sense, right? You basically start the baseball season as March Madness is winding down, and you can build up more interest in baseball season, especially up here.
You can play baseball in July. I've seen it happen. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean,
when it's hot out,
America,
you can play.
America shuts down in July.
Yep. It. You know. You can be on the dirt in 100-degree heat. It's not that bad. I've seen it done. I mean, it's about the corruption. It's really just about the, you know, the teams down there. Who got control, did this purposely, and been moving it back purposely because they don't want to have to compete with Northern teams. You shrink the pool of teams that it's viable to go to, and that helps their programs. And the NCAA has been controlled by this cartel for a long time now. And we saw it take place in the, you know, in the seating here. I think Angelique put an article out this morning talking to the guy who is the director of the committee, who, by the way, is from North Dakota State. But she asked him, like, "What did you guys make these decisions on?" And he said, you know, the Big Ten played an all Big Ten schedule, and we really wanted to reward the SEC for going out and playing harder non-conference teams. Well, it's during a pandemic. There's a reason why the Big Ten didn't play other non-conference. So they punished the Big Ten for trying to protect their players and trying to protect their universities and their communities from an international pandemic by I think they chopped about half the Big Ten teams that should have been in the tournament out of it, right? They only got three teams in. And I mean, Michigan's seeding, you know, Michigan's ranked, I think, number 20 in the national polls, and they have 16 spots. So I mean, I understand Michigan not getting a regional. I think that I agree that, like, if you're looking at it and you have the number 20 team is the, you know, the best team in the, and they didn't play anybody outside of the conference, I think that there's more than enough there to say, okay, at least we need to have one Midwest regional, right? But I understand Michigan not making it. Washington really, really got hosed. And anyone, including Agreed. Michigan, in Washington's bracket gets hosed. Because I think they were number like 5 or 6.
Yeah, the last poll that had them, I think it was number 5. Michigan had fallen from, I don't even know how this happened. They fell from 18 to 20 in the last poll, even though they won all their last games. One of the things that Michigan has what allows Michigan every year, because a lot of times they do start in that range, in that, you know, mid-teens to low-teens or 20 when the polls first come out. But then they open the year and play Florida and they beat them, or they play LSU and they beat them, or they play UCLA and they beat them. They end up with three or four wins over really big teams from the South or the West. And by the time they're as Craig was talking about, the ridiculously expensive portion of the season is over, you come home and you're now in the top 10 because you've had those games. They didn't have those games. But as you said,
And Georgia got a regional. They weren't even ranked. I mean, it was the cartel. And the cartel was using the fact that they had their that they played all of each other. It's the same, you know, circle talk that you get all the time from the SEC and in BCS rankings and playoff rankings and stuff, right? Like, we're the toughest conference because we all played each other. And really, when you go look at them, you know, they're all 9-7 against each other, and then they, you know, don't do nearly as well in the postseason. And it's infuriating because they left certain teams out. It's infuriating because they bunched a lot of teams outside of their region so that, like, they can guarantee that a lot of SEC teams are going to make it far in the tournament before they have to play anybody. And who knows? Maybe this is the straw that breaks the camel's back, that the Big Ten and Pac-10 or 12 are going to finally get together and say, that's enough. This is just way too much. But the Pac-12 has, you know, USC and Arizona in it, and they love being in the NCAA. So I don't know how much they're going to, you know, I don't know if they can get a consensus. But I know Washington is even more furious than Michigan because they were number 5 in the country and they got the 16th seed. Not only do they have to play Michigan, and then they have to play Oklahoma next. It's just, it was absolutely ludicrous.
It's probably hard to get consensus in any of these other leagues to join the Big Ten because the Big Ten are all northern teams, right?
Yeah.
But the Pac-12 is a mix. The ACC is a mix. The Big 12 is a mix with mainly southern teams, and obviously the SEC is all southern teams. So there's no other league, power league, built like the Big Ten to have all northern teams to help get you with consensus. Who wants to? It doesn't seem like the Big Ten really wants to play nice. Plus, enough of this to you, Brian. The Big Ten and the Pac-12 are talking about being the conferences to try to spearhead this. Aren't these the ones with the two most, the least experienced commissioners that probably don't have any clout within their leagues or within their brethren amongst the other conference commissioners? How would those leaders that have PR nightmares behind them now would even orchestrate this?
Well, I mean, you know, I think the thing that Bakich's proposal did is it looked at attendance for SEC teams. And when they're playing in February and March, those are often day games because night games are unpleasant, even on a Friday. And so their attendance goes up as the season goes along, because as the season goes along, once you hit April and May, like, there's not really a whole lot going on right now on a college campus. But in February and in March, there's a thing called March Madness. And getting as much baseball and softball away from March Madness and sort of giving it its own part of the calendar, particularly when we talk about college sports, is something that I think the attempt to sell these southern teams is that you will make more money doing this. Your sport will not seem as much of a drain on coffers, and you might get a third assistant coach. And so I don't know if that's a commissioner issue or not. I think it's really just like convincing enough teams that live south of the Mason-Dixon line that this is good for their bottom line and that's good for the sport, even if it makes some additional teams more viable. And like, I don't think we're going to see a sea change in what baseball is in this country, even if this is adopted. So, you know, the SEC is always going to be the power conference, and the Big Ten is going to try to scrap and get some teams in. And I don't think that the SEC teams are going to be operating under the assumption that this is going to really, like, hurt them. And so it's about whether they can be convinced that this is good for their bottom line. And I don't know if the commissioners are going to do that or not. I think it's more of coaches, ADs level kind of thing.
Well, on the baseball side, it'll take about 2 years for the SEC to decide what the Big Ten has done is right, if the Big Ten and other schools would leave. And here's why. One, they'll make money. Because you start, if you went down to Fisher Stadium, if there was a game against Ohio State or Notre Dame or Michigan State on a Friday night and Saturday night in the summer, that selling beer, that place is going to be packed.
They're not going to sell. Why would they sell beer at a baseball game?
Because you can make money. Because you make money selling beer.
They don't sell it at any.
Who cares? Sell it. and you sell beer, you have people there.
Also, we should all dress like clowns.
and you use wooden bats, which scouts now love, and they don't, and so they're paying more attention to what happens in those games than in games with the fake bats. And all of a sudden, the Midwest, the Big Ten is making money. The SEC isn't. What's going to happen then? And after all, I know this is a radical idea, but you know when they play baseball? In the summer. Thanks, Kurt. They play in the summer. It's called the summer game. It's not called the January and February game and March game. So this is, you know.
Remember who you're dealing with. The SEC will absolutely cut off their nose despite their face. They do it in every single sport. They're the mob. They're not going to. I think that, you know, Brian's correct that you can show them and say, look, you're hurting your bottom line. But I think the smart ones already knew that they were going to hurt their bottom line by doing this. But they knew what's going on campus. They live on campus. They know what basketball is happening. I think that it was worth it to them to screw themselves out of 25% of their revenue to screw the North out of 80% of their revenue.
I mean, I just don't buy that. I just simply do not buy that. There is no way that they're afraid of one conference, like, upsetting their current hegemony. It's just, like, not going to happen. Like, it's not going to change anything if, like, they move the season back much. It's just not going to be that big of a deal. So, you know, I think it's easy to say no to this because, you know, you have this kind of tradition and momentum that these things sort of happen. And maybe COVID and the sort of athletic department budget issues that are rampant because of it are something that might move the needle, because the costs that you have that you're enduring because of this setup no longer seem as tenable.
I'm curious if they'll look at costs and say, you know, because not the Big Ten, not the SEC, but you're talking about moving the tournament, right? Pushing everything back. That means everybody is going to be involved in this decision. What about those bottom conferences that may look and say, we're not going to pay for housing of our student athletes in the summertime. We're not going to pay for this in the summertime that we normally wouldn't do. Does it matter to you that it might break that part of it up? Does it even matter in college baseball if the smaller conferences are not playing in the baseball tournament or not?
My guess is they'll cut costs and make money. And because you're going to be dealing with bus trips, you know, Toledo doesn't have to, you know, for example, figure out how to play down in Birmingham. I mean, I think I read, I could be wrong, but I think I read it costs Michigan baseball $50,000 to $60,000 a weekend for a trip in the South. Well, it ain't going to cost Toledo $50,000 or $60,000 to take a bus trip up to Ann Arbor. And if they're here, they can stay in University of Michigan housing for the weekend. I don't see that. You know what it's also good for? Students. Because now you can actually be a student in February and March, and when school is generally less hot, when it's not quite as intense in the summer, you can play baseball or softball. And so it's also ideal for student athletes. Someone like Megan Bobian, for example, who I believe is a biomedical engineering student with a 4.0 average or whatever. You know, it's good for her. And it seems to me, that's a good thing. So I don't get it. You know, if the SEC, as Brian suggests, and he may be right, that, you know, just says, oh, the hell with you guys, do your own thing. Okay, good. We'll do our own thing. We'll make money. We'll have our own championships. And, you know, that's it. I don't see the downside. Because
you're underestimating how many small teams there are in the South. It's not the SEC. Well, it's not just the SEC. This is there are. If you look at the tournament field, there are a ton of teams from small schools in the South, some of which you probably never even heard of. And they're worried about the MAC. They're worried about the the Big West and stuff. We're always behind this. And remember, the NCAA votes as a big body. It's not just these power conferences that are driving this. So it's not just these ACC and SEC teams. You know, these South Alabamas, UNC Greensville, and those schools are the ones who are pushing this as well. And that's where a lot of the momentum comes from. And when I say that they're a cartel, it's like those schools, they know what's up. They know how few people are going to come and watch a game at any time. And they know that as long as they're competing and they're getting into the playoffs, that's the only thing that matters to them. And if there's a larger field, if there's 100 viable teams instead of 50 viable teams, then they're the ones who are going to get put on the outs. And that's why they're behind this stuff.
All right, guys, we're going to step aside, take a break. We have more of the MGO Blog Roundtable on the radio to continue on the other side of the break. We'll continue online on Ticket TV. We are streaming live on Facebook, on Twitter, and on YouTube. But we'll continue on the other side of the break here on the radio on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, The Ticket.
By the way, I think Hutch just killed it in recruiting for next year. I don't know if that's something any of you guys have looked at, but she's got 5 kids coming in, and on the recruiting site that looks at this, they're number 8, 16, 26, 44, and 101. And the 101 kid is only 101 because she plays in Monroe, Michigan. And she's almost a 600 lifetime hitter with all kinds of speed. And so they really have killed it on the recruiting front. I don't know. Maybe you guys know. In terms of what players are eligible to come back,
everyone is eligible for a well. They all got the COVID shirts last year, the ones that took the extra year already obviously are going to be gone. Like, so Thais Gonzalez, she's already used her year, but everybody else gets an extra year of eligibility.
So it's we're going to get another year of both.
But the difference is now the. And I believe this is going to be the case across the board that the scholarships won't be any scholarship exemptions. I believe they have you get the 1 year for basketball. This year coming up is going to be a scholarship exemption year for basketball.
Yes.
But after that, you have to be with your 13. You have to have your number.
Is this the year that's the scholarship exemption for softball?
This is the year we're in is the scholarship exemption year for softball. I don't know if they're going to extend it for another year or not. In which case, then it will come down, as far as I've interpreted, this kid wants to walk on, and because not everyone's on full scholarship anyway, but it comes down to you're back to the whatever that unique percent of scholarships. I know baseball is like 11.2% or whatever it is. It's like some
weird. Yeah, it's 11.7 scholarships.
Yeah, there you go.
Which incidentally, I couldn't figure out how Vanderbilt could have about 30, which they do. And Michigan probably has 13 or 14 as I try to figure it out, because in Michigan, as I get it, if you're an in-state resident and your family income is under $60,000, you don't have to pay tuition. I think tuition is waived.
The Hale program.
Right. And so my guess is they can get a couple of kids a year in baseball under that program and then give them half scholarships. And so you end up with basically 13, maybe 14, depending on what we've done. I think, for example, and I have no idea about these kids' families' incomes, but for example, Tito Flores is, I think, from Detroit and would be eligible, assuming his family fits on the income requirements.
I mean, Vanderbilt. It's like the Ivy League, right? Yeah, they don't have any scholarships, but they give scholarships, right?
Yeah. So. I mean, my brother knows this very well. If I never told you the story, Vanderbilt has this for any student anywhere, and it's not just tuition, it's all costs of attendance. So if your family income is at a certain level, and someone is saying it's not income, it's net worth, okay, so maybe that's right. So if your income or your net worth or whatever the marker is sufficient, you at Vanderbilt, you can get a full scholarship.
Harvard does that.
Pardon me?
Harvard does that too.
And that's basically how my brother played football at Cornell with no cost. I'm thinking that Vanderbilt, you wonder how can Vanderbilt have all these guys on their team and all? Well, I have a hunch that it's because of their endowment allows them to do that, and they have rules as a private school that allows them to have more than the 11.7 scholarships or that are allowed for other schools.
All right, guys, we're coming back on radio in about 10 seconds, so stand by. Welcome back to the second half of the MGO Blog Roundtable here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK. The Ticket, online at WTK.com and also on Ticket TV. We're streaming live on Facebook, YouTube, and on Twitter. Joined by Brian Cook, Craig Ross, and Seth Fisher. And before we get into Michigan football, I want to talk a little Michigan football with you guys. Brian, I know you're a big Matt Campbell guy. Matt Campbell, did you see the story? I'm just curious your thoughts on turning down an 8-year, $68.5 million contract to the Lions. That seems, if I'm Mac, I would downgrade Matt Campbell now because I'd take that contract.
What?
According to CBS Sports, Matt Campbell was offered a contract by the Detroit Lions for 8 years, $68.5 million, and he turned it down.
And full control.
And full control. Well, and turned it down. Thought he was a smart guy.
He is a smart guy.
We're down the field.
How much money would it take for me to be the head coach of the Detroit Lions? It's not a number. It doesn't exist. It's cursed. That man knows to stay away from curses, which doesn't really.
I would do it for $100.
It's plausible.
You would coach the Detroit Lions for $100?
$100.
You already have all the curses. You can't be more cursed than you already are. That's why.
That's possibly true. But come on, tell me if someone didn't come to you and said, hey, you can coach the Detroit Lions this year. I'm completely incompetent to coach peewee football. But if someone said to you, you can coach the Detroit Lions next year, I'll say, okay, I'll do that. What's the salary? I don't care.
It's plausible that Sheila Ford is not going to be the disaster every other Ford has been, but I would wait and find out before I took that job. What I think is crazy is Matt Campbell, who is a very, you know, known as a very even-keeled guy, you know, beloved by his players, and doesn't really shout and get too heated and whatnot, that they were looking at Matt Campbell, and then when they didn't get Matt, they went to Dan Campbell, who's the exact opposite person. So, like, what were the qualifications they were looking at? Like, were they going alphabetically, or like, just like, okay, C, all right, Dan Campbell, that's our guy. I don't know how the same process that offered Matt Campbell gets Dan Campbell.
Only the Campbells apply? I mean, it had to be maybe a name thing. They are pretty opposite guys.
If Dan turned him down?
Yeah. He's in line for wide receiver coach. All right. Well, go ahead, Craig.
I have a question about that, though. I mean, I assume he's making good money at Iowa State. I don't know what exactly.
He makes about $4 million a year.
$4 million. And there could be some people who decide, you know, I'm in a really good situation here. I'm sort of even iconic in this state. I'm making $4 million a year. As long as I work hard, reasonably hard, I'm always going to be in that situation. And so why is an extra $4 million at some point in my life really make any difference? And you know, it's not like my value goes to ground. It's not like that offer may not be there next year when the Lions are 2-14 again, or 2-15, because I guess there's 17 games this year. You know, I sort of get it from his point of view. I mean,
well, I don't know what the answer to this question is, but mm-hmm. How many people have gotten a head coaching job after being the Lions head coach?
Ooh, good question.
So
it's a very low list. You're correct. And
so yeah, if
job security is a big part of this, I'm sure.
Right. If he has designs on a major college job, going to the Lions would be dumb. And like, how guaranteed is that contract, right? Because 8 years, $68 million sounds good. But if you get fired after a year and a half, like that, then you're in a completely different spot. So if it's a Jimbo Fisher contract, okay, maybe. But it probably isn't.
We'd all take the Jimbo Fisher contract. Every single one of us, I think, would take a Jimbo Fisher contract because that's all guaranteed. Those are big dollars. All guaranteed.
Yeah, so you guys know who Jordan Strack is. He covers Michigan for Toledo. He also covers Toledo, yeah. And so he covered Campbell when he was there for a long time, and I think he still has a relationship. Strack, by the way, is the one who asked the question that led to Brady Hoke saying, "This is Michigan, for God's sakes," if you're wondering who that is. But he knows Campbell pretty well. And when we were talking about this stuff last winter, he was pretty clear that Matt Campbell was going to take the Michigan job if it was offered. And I think that that's probably where It's possible that ISU, that Ames, Iowa is his final stop, but I don't think so. I think that he knows that
nobody has ever stayed in Ames, Iowa.
So
6 months tops, and then you gotta
Johnny, have you been to Ames? Orton. It's actually not that it's as far as farm towns, it's not the worst.
Well, okay, that's quite a sentence.
So you're saying is $4 million a year goes a long way in Ames, Iowa.
Anyway, it's no Iowa City. I think that he knows that he's in line for a pretty big job, and I think that like the Michigan job would probably be number one on his list. I think that Texas looked at him too, but Campbell is not down for doing some of the things that Texas builds its program around, so that kind of fell through. But I did hear some inside stuff about how that went down that makes me think Campbell definitely wants to have like one of those premier jobs.
And if you're a college guy, I mean, you can go to the pros and go back to college, but if you want to be on the college trajectory, it makes sense to be in college. All right, on the Michigan front here, guys, we're kind of on, I guess, on watch for the beef. We're looking for beef, helping out the middle. Seth, you and I were talking about it earlier. They're looking for beef, and maybe they're going to find, I mean, even if it's just a flyer, right? Take a flyer on a guy. If the guy weighs 370 pounds, why not, right?
354, I think, is what he said on Radio with Sam. But yeah, Jordan Whitley from Oregon State. I tried to pull up some games, but he was injured a bit last year, so it was hard to find spots when he was out there. But yeah, man, it's a lot of beef in the middle that Michigan needs, and they're telling you right now that they need a nose guard. So I think that even if Michigan's going into this year going, okay, Mozzie Smith can be our nose tackle, and I think Hinton and Jeter could be the guys flanking him on either side at the tackle positions. I think that they know they need at least somebody to rotate in there, and they don't have anybody like that on the roster right now. So, yeah, I mean, if it's not him, they'll keep moving down the line, but they've taken a couple swings already, and guys just weren't interested or went other places or whatnot. So, I think Whitley, they're coming at him very hard because of who he is, because they need that type of player, and I think that they're offering a backup position, and I think that most likely it's going to happen.
So do you guys perceive that Michigan or the new defensive coordinators are moving to a 3-4 with a two-gap guy on the nose? I mean, is that...
Yes.
Yes, that's what this means.
They're multiple. Which literally every defense in the country is multiple. Is. High school defenses are multiple. But I mean, what they mean by that, of course, is that they'll shift their fronts around. And if you watch anything from the Ravens, you'll get exactly what they're going for. I had it pulled up. This is from my article that if you look across the line, starting from the outside linebackers, 2019 Ravens, Jalen Ferguson, 6'5", 275. Brandon Williams, a tackle, at 6'1", 336. Michael Pierce, at 6'0", 340. Wormley, at 6'5", 300. And then Matt Judon was the other outside linebacker, at 6'3", 275. All of those guys, all five of those guys, are larger than who Michigan was starting at defensive tackle last year. So that's what you're looking for, and that's what that defense is predicated on, is, look, you're not going to get pushed around anymore. That duo play that Harbaugh kind of brought back and Ohio State rammed down our throats in 2019, that's not going to happen anymore. They're going to start with that.
Yeah, your point is very well laid out. The three middle guys are big. Now, they may range a little bit in what their skills are, what they need to be, and how big they are, but the three down linemen in the Ravens defense, which is what we're expecting to look like here, they are big fellas. And then the two guys on the outside that are flanking, aren't they? They're almost big enough to put the hand in the dirt.
They are. They're four-three defensive ends who are given a little bit more. Yeah, so like last year we were running Aiden Hutchinson and throwing him into the B gap all the time to help out the tackles. And that kind of took away, I mean, Aiden was great at it. But I think that took away from what he's really good at, which is his athleticism on the outside for his size is just off the charts. And that is kind of what this is going to focus on. Unfortunately, he wasn't available for spring because of his injury last year. But you know, that's the kind of that, the more I look at this defense, the more I'm thinking we're not talking about, like, you know, Josh Uche kind of players out there. We're talking about Aiden
bigger
Hutchinson
guys, right?
And, yeah, and letting
long
him
and
really
athletic
go.
And bigger. Yeah, long, yeah. Athletic and bigger in that, yeah. 260 is light. 270 yeah. plus is probably pretty good. But the guys in the middle, as I said, the same. I want to be able to introduce them as a 6-man tag team and say at a combined weight of over 1,000 pounds. Like, that's how you want to introduce your defense in front of this defense. You have to get to that point maybe at some point down the road.
That's Survivor Series.
Yes, Survivor Series. Yeah. Yeah, something like that. Something like that. And maybe this is the guy stop at, because you can't fill this in. I mean, based on how recruiting has been at this position for the last however many years, it's not gonna, you're not gonna fill it all in a year. But
I mean, doesn't this just feel incredibly doomed? Like, you're talking about you're talking about what they want to do, and then you look at the roster and it's like Chris Jenkins, who's 250 and is like trying to bulk up, and it's like, okay, maybe he can get there, but
squint,
not
and you can
year.
See his dad. If you squint, you can see his
yes,
dad.
if you squint and you like fast forward 2 years into the future, but unfortunately,
that's stopgap measures. That's why a guy like Whitley is like a stopgap guy, right? Where you're just trying to get bodies, because they have a couple body, they have a body for each of these starting positions.
But that's what it is. You're gonna get bodies. You're getting an Oregon State transfer. Oregon State. I think it. This doesn't. This conversation is not making me feel more encouraged.
I understand that. I'm not. I don't think anyone is super highly encouraged based on what we know coming back on the returning players for the defensive front in particular. Because even if they're playing the same defense, we've had these conversations about the lack of beef up front, right?
Yeah.
The fact is, if they try to run Don Brown's system again next year, they're going to have the same personnel problems they had last year. So, like, you know, unless you're going to go out and get those dynamic tackles that he had when we were killing it in 2016, 2017, you need to do something, right? And Michigan has been trying to get another Mo Hurst and trying to manufacture them, try to get a small guy and bulk him up and whatnot, and they haven't gotten one. So this is the cheaper answer, because otherwise you're getting killed. They sacrificed everything they had last year to try to make up for the fact they had no beef down the middle, and it fell apart. They fell apart on the edges. They had Hutchinson and Quiddipay, like, not doing all the things that they're capable of. They wasted half of a year of Josh Uche. Like, that's what was going on with this program. So, you know, you gotta do something, and this is one option.
What else have you learned, Seth? I'll go ahead, Craig, before we get to
I was just going to say that last phrase, you got to do something, feels like Michigan football for at least the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, and so I don't know. I hope it works is all I can say. I'm not quite at the doomed stage where Brian is, because we haven't seen anything.
Why not? possible?
Well,
this system works fine. If you're teaching the system and you're recruiting the system, Wisconsin runs something like this.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's not gap sound. I'm saying that you can't do it in a year, and that's all you got, right?
Yeah,
I say this all the time. I'll let you guys pretend.
I mean, what is he? What do you want him to do? What do you want Jim Harbaugh doing right now? If he's got
to
fix this,
I want him to call Matt Campbell and be like, I'm out.
Yeah, well, that one ain't happening, I don't think.
The most important thing that he did this offseason is he did get recruiters, which are going to get players on campus. He got guys who are going to stick around even if he doesn't, and that allows them to actually have some players. So if it's him, if it's the next guy, at least Michigan's got a future. At least he's not throwing everything into the bucket and saying, okay, let's try to coach what we got up and try to beat Ohio State next year, or it's all over, and then it's all over and there's nothing left in the cupboard, right?
So, Brian, what are you optimistic about? I want some rays of light optimism. It doesn't have to be Michigan football. Just what gives you optimism on this Thursday morning? Michigan something related. Let me football. Just Michigan related.
I have plenty of optimism about basketball and hockey.
All right, well, let's hear some of it. I want to hear some rays of sunshine coming from Brian Cook.
Well, I mean, people who I've been talking to and who are different from Craig's sources do kind of think that Michigan is likely to get back a large number of these highly rated freshmen next year. So if Owen Power goes first overall, the first overall pick always gets signed, even if it's kind of an off year. But things about, you know, Bortolo probably coming back, Meniere's probably coming back, Kent Johnson probably coming back. That's exciting. That would be good. Now, I don't think that you're going to get that lucky and get everybody back. But as long as they get a couple of these guys back, you're going to get some reinforcements next year. You got Luke Hughes coming in, who's another guy who's going to be a top five pick probably. You have Ethan Edwards. You have Mackie Samoskevich, who's going to be probably a late first-round pick. Dylan Duke is sometimes in that conversation, probably more of a second-rounder. But Thomas Bortolo is a second-rounder, right? And Dylan Duke brings you a lot of the stuff that they kind of lacked on their top two lines, because he is just a ball of energy who will go in the corners and fish a puck out. And, you know, they lose Strauss Mann, but hey, they have a third-round pick who had an understudy year, who's going to be a sophomore this year, who's like 600 feet tall. It's going to be fine. Get vaccinated so I can go to Yost, you yutzes. Come on.
I agree that there's a lot to be happy about with hockey, and that hockey, I think will have at least some reasonable percentage of those freshmen coming back this year from what I've heard. And it should be a really fun team. Obviously, basketball should be really interesting. Now, I saw that somebody, the guy who does the bracketology, Lenardi, has Michigan as a one seed in the tournament next year. I might suggest that's a little soon for a program bringing six freshmen in, but it's going to be very interesting. It'll be a very interesting and fun team.
I'm sure Kentucky was a one seed at this time last year. Prices are so ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, Michigan was a one seed last year, and they return, they return quite a bit of that team. And
I mean, the thing is that, so you're bringing in the six freshmen, you have all this hype about the six freshmen, but if you actually go look at the minutes, exactly one of them is going to be a guy you need to hit. And that's Caleb Houston, right? Because he's got to be your starting three, and he's got to be a knockdown shooter. But that's the easiest thing for a freshman to do. Stand in the corner and just nail threes. And he's very practiced at that. If you watch his game, he is a very mature game. He's going to slot right in. And then you're just looking for a couple of those guys to come through. And Musa Diabate is the kind of player where his floor is super high, because he's going to be one of the best defensive centers in America, even if he's playing the four sometimes. And so, it's not going to be a Kentucky situation where you're walking in and you're like, you don't know where your usage is coming from. You don't know if, I think it's BJ Boston is just going to completely fail to translate to college. You know, you have Hunter Dickinson, you know, you have Eli Brooks, you know, you have Brandon Johns, and then we don't know what we're going to get from Brandon Johns exactly, but he's going to be a solid Big Ten four. And so you just need to plug in a couple of pieces around him, and then you've got a team. So I don't think the Kentucky Duke stuff is the way this season feels, even though Michigan has the best recruiting class in the country.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And I'm also really super optimistic about Kobe Bufkin. I heard an interview with him, and it was so smart, talking about how, he knows what the weaknesses of his game are, and he's doing nothing this summer but shooting with his right hand. But and
like around the basket, you mean?
All over. He's working on his right hand.
He's a lefty. He doesn't need to.
He's a lefty. And when I hear a lefty,
why would you shoot with your weak hand?
Because the more you shoot with your weak hand, the better of a basketball player you are. Look at Iggy Brazdeikis. Now, he was actually a righty playing left-handed, but he, that's a skill that's immeasurable. And I hear Hunter Dickinson saying, I'm working on my right hand.
Okay, but like around the bucket is
different. Yeah, around the basket. But for Kobe, it's going to be taking it to the rim with his left hand, dribbling with his right hand, his offhand. And so, and I love his game. The more I've looked at him, the more I love his game. And so I'm, but to call them, to put them in at a one seed now is absurd. To put anyone maybe at a one seed now is an absurdity.
I just had Gonzaga in there. I think
maybe Gonzaga,
They got Chet too, didn't they?
They got another five star too. It's currently out of control. I don't know how they didn't pass Michigan, but.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I just want Bufkin stapled to John Sanderson this summer. Like that, he's a little bit wiry for me right now.
He's wiry, but he's not. I saw him playing with some NBA guys. He's not weak.
Yeah,
he you know, look at Jalen. When Jalen came in, Jalen was skinny as all get out. He was not weak. And actually, there's some, except for the fact that Bufkin has an actual jump shot and Jalen never really did. They are, and Bufkin is obviously 4 inches shorter, but they're kind of similar guys when you look at them, and in terms of their games. You're talking about glimmers. This has been an incredible season for Michigan sports among spring sports. I mean, there's been remarkable success. The only thing we need is, let me mention track and the Big Ten championship. Zia Holman, a freshman, won the 400s. I think she probably has at least a vague shot in the NCAA. Her time was phenomenal. Was a Michigan record at 51.88.
She's a meme. I know you're not on the internet, Craig, but like video of Zia, passing everybody to win that race. Yeah.
I've seen that. It
keeps popping up in coaching circles all the time because they're always looking for some sort of super motivational whatever.
they won. Andrew Liskovitz, 65-7 was first in the Big Ten shot put. And I'm going to blow her name, but it might be Aurora Rinda, won the 800 easily, 800 meters easily, and just killed it with a phenomenal time. She's a sophomore. And then what I'm stunned that I haven't heard more about is Aiden Owens, who was a transfer, I think, from UCLA, set the U of M record, won the Big Tens in the decathlon, set the U of M record. And it's the number two score in the NCAA this year, number two in Big Ten history, the fifth highest score in the world this year. And so it wouldn't stun me at all to see him in the Olympic Games coming up in the decathlon. Depends, I think, what happens with him in the NCAAs. But what he did was just phenomenal. So, I mean, and no one's even talking about those sports because you got baseball being a success and softball being a success. And all we need in field hockey, all Michigan needs in field hockey is Brian Cook to change the stupid rules. Brian is a genius at altering rules in games and saying, we shouldn't have this and that, no offside here or whatever. And they're very clever ideas. And the problem with field hockey is just the rules.
There's way too many that nobody understands unless they're in the game, and then even the refs don't necessarily understand them.
Right, exactly.
Well, so one thing that kind of leapt out about watching that field hockey game is it seems like there's so much emphasis on protecting the players from potential injury.
Yeah.
And they don't wear any pads.
Right.
And it's like, it's a very strange thing to have a game that the physicality is completely prohibited, and you see people kind of like rub someone off the ball and then get the ball, and then that's illegal, and you're like, that shouldn't be illegal. That happens in every sport that I've ever seen.
Right.
I think there was a goal on which it seemed like a Michigan player got out of the way of the ball, where, and I was just like, what?
Right. I mean, there needs to be some adjustment in the rules to that game, because actually I had never really seen a game, and I watched the national championship game, and it was fun. I mean, it really was a fun game to watch, except for the complete craziness of the rules. And
then I guess we'll see Anchor Field this fall, because they're going to be right back at it in the fall. They have a very quick turnaround for a normal fall sport. We'll see you at Anchor Field. Guys, we are actually, believe it or not, amazingly, we're out of time, and probably have more to talk about, so we'll probably reconvene this again next week. We'll check in with you.
I'll be here
next week to see. Craig will be here because the summer of Craig will happen no matter what.
Appreciate it
as always. Thanks to Brian Cook and Craig Ross and Seth Fisher for joining me here on the show. Thanks to all of you for listening to the show. This has been the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA Ann Arbor, a Cumulus station.
We'll get to Virchow yet there, Craig. Don't worry.
We'll get to Virchow at some point when we really get desperate, because Virchow is really interesting.
We will definitely. Russian Revolution history. We have all kinds of stuff prepared for Craig.
Yeah.
Have you... We'll get to Virchow yet there, Craig. Don't worry.
We'll get to Virchow at some point when we really get desperate.